Thank you, Dr. Brevik. Pleasure and honor to be the opening speaker to this symposium on the important topic of civilization, soil, land, vegetation, environment. Some 10 millennia ago, a very short time in the history of our species, human beings first ventured out of the continent of Africa, that is Homo sapiens, wise humans, first came out of Africa and fanned out through the so-called Fertile Crescent and beyond that into the continents of Asia and Europe and even beyond that. And so we have a physical map here of the ancient Fertile Crescent, and I'd like to explain the kind of environment that they encountered. It was following the last ice age, the final gasps of the Pleistocene, the beginning of the Holocene, and there was a great change in climate, a warming trend, and a great profusion of plants and animals. And what they found in the Middle East is it was a very variegated environment, at least five ecological domains. The first of these domains was the arc of highlands girding the Fertile Crescent. Imagine that arc extending from the southeastern shore of the Mediterranean and arching over the Taurus Mountains of southeastern Turkey today and on to the Zagros Mountains. And there is a region there that has a profusion of rainfall and a profusion of plants, among which were those that could be readily domesticated, including wheat and barley and oats and rye and lentils and some of the fruit trees, the almond and the pomegranate and especially the olive and the grapevine. And so it was here that human beings first made the momentous transition from life as hunters, gatherers, scavengers, wandering in small bands over the land, and became sedentary and developed agriculture, domesticated the first crop plants. A very short time ago, as I said, only about give or take 10, 12,000 years ago, the so-called Neolithic Revolution. Now, in the rain shadow of these rain-fed highlands was a wide array, a wide zone of undulating hills that did not afford sufficient rainfall to permit stable farming, but nonetheless had a sufficiency of vegetative resources to permit an alternative lifestyle, a lifestyle based on grazing ungulates, goats and sheep mostly, and then cattle. And so an alternative lifestyle developed that we call the pastoral lifestyle. So side by side and in close interaction with the agricultural lifestyle, the farming domain was the pastoral domain, the domain of the pastoralists, the sheep herders. Now beyond that, of course, lay the great desert, which is part and parcel of the greatest desert in the world, the so-called Sahara. We call it the Sahara Desert. The Sahara means desert. So when you say the Sahara Desert, what you're saying is the desert desert. And you're right, because it is the greatest desert in the world. It starts all the way out in at the Atlantic Ocean, and it expands all through North Africa and through the Middle East and on all the way to northwestern India, the so-called Thar Desert or of Rajasthan. So that's the third ecological domain. The fourth ecological domain, which is extremely important in the history of civilization, are the river valleys. The river valleys are where the excess runoff from the rain-fed domain flows into these valleys that would otherwise be completely arid, but with the increment of the rivers, and during certain periods of the year, these rivers were in spate, and the water rose and flooded over the floodplain. And so they afforded special conditions where civilizations that began in the rain-fed domain and domesticated crops could then carry the seeds to the river valleys and plant these seeds along the water courses at the recession of the flood. And then these people learned to divert water from the rivers and to spread water over the land and develop a new kind of agriculture, irrigation-based, that we might call the hydraulic civilizations of antiquity. And I'm referring especially to the valleys of the Tigris and the Euphrates, what is today Iraq. Uruk, by the way, Iraq means, the word means artery, the artery of the waters feeding the land. And then, of course, the Nile Valley. These are the principal river valleys of the Middle East. In addition, there are the smaller river valleys of the Jordan and the Orontes and the Litani. But the principal centers of hydraulic civilization were Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley. And the fifth ecological domain are the shorelines, that is the maritime domain where the land meets the sea, and there are special circumstances that permitted the development of a lifestyle based on coastal fishing and the utilization of the coastal resources, sand to make glass and murex snails to extract dyes and various other goods that were available along the coast. And finally, after shipbuilding began using the cedars of Lebanon, the people along the coastal domain became mariners, and they traversed the seas and engaged in trade. The people of the desert, by the way, remained for a long time sort of isolated, a very sparse population, but at some point in their history they domesticated a marvelous animal called the dromedary or the camel. And then they became caravaneers, able to convey precious goods from distant sources of supply to the centers of population in the river valleys and along the seacoast. And what were these precious commodities? There were medicinal herbs and aromatic herbs and precious stones and eventually silk from far away. So they became the traders of antiquity. Now we'll go and proceed, if I can find the right button. And I think this is it, or maybe that's not it. And how do I do this? Where? Down. Very good. Here you have the distribution. Can you hear me without the benefit of the microphone? Good. Okay, so that is the sort of distribution of rainfall. And you can see the gradation of the rain-fed to the semi-arid pastoral domain to the desert domain. And this is also the gradation of vegetation from the dense forests of the rain-fed domain gradually moving on to the semi-arid and the arid and the hyper-arid deserts, the Sahara. And this is sort of the geographic distribution of these domains. Here's an example of the remnant forest of the rain-fed domain in the mountains of Lebanon. This is the famed and fabled cedar of Lebanon that was in antiquity used for the construction of ships and also palaces. And there are many references to the trading in the cedars of Lebanon. And this is only a remnant forest. You see in the background that the forest has been decimated, cleared, and many of these hillsides are now devoid of that original rich vegetation and highly, highly eroded. This is a symbol of the belief of the people, because the conditions that controlled the lives of the ancient societies affected not only their material mode of life, but also their perceptions of the forces of nature that conditioned their lives, and they deified these forces and worshiped them. And here is a depiction, an ancient depiction of the god of rain, the god Baal or Baal, depicted as a kind of a cowboy riding the clouds and at will or whim hurling his thunderbolts or striking his mallet at the clouds above and spilling down rain upon the recumbent Mother Earth. And where is Mother Earth? If I can find her. No, I can't find her. Where is she? Help me.
Now hit your down arrow.
The down arrow. There's the recumbent Mother Earth depicted. And she was had various names. She was called Asherah or Ashtarte or Tanit. And she was depicted as being a very fecund. And so the whole process of fructification of agriculture was depicted as kind of sexual mating of the sky god with the earth goddess. And there is the semi-arid domain where the land, where the trees become sparse, and there is a growth of clumps of grasses that could be grazed by ungulates. And the pastoralists, of course, believed in the prowess and fecundity of animal gods, and they worshipped the golden calf or the ram, as we have references in some of the ancient writ, including the Bible. And the Bible, of course, can be viewed from various points of view, theological, linguistic, archaeological. I'm going to avoid the theology of the Bible, but only concentrate on the fact that it spans 1,000 years in the history of civilization, and it has numerous references to the ecology of the region. Now here is the stages in what today we call desertification, which is the exploitation of the land. Land that was a kind of an open scrub forest of scattered trees and grasses, gradually cleared, cultivated, eroded, and finally desertified. So if you go to the Middle East today, you find vast stretches of land that were once upon a time highly productive, but are now sadly degraded by, among other processes, the process of soil erosion. The ancient people devised means of controlling soil erosion by building terraces on the hillsides, but these terraces, of course, needed to be maintained. You break the slope up into a series of steps, but these steps need to be maintained, and if they're neglected, the terraces slump, and the land can be completely denuded, and it becomes exposed bedrock. There's the desert domain that I mentioned before, and its sparse growth. The hillsides are completely sterile. What little vegetation exists concentrates around the gulches or arroyos, or what they're called. They're called wadis in the Middle East, and they run with water periodically, perhaps only once or twice a year, and some years not at all. But there is sufficient moisture during percolates into the soil, into the subsoil during these periodic floods to give rise to clumps of vegetation. Now, some of the ancient people were very clever in learning how to divert water from the streams during floods and spread the water on the adjacent flat land and cultivate that, what we call runoff farming. There were thriving societies that subsisted on runoff farming in those days. They even learned how to collect water from hillsides and collect that water in underground excavated cisterns that needed to be plastered so that the walls became impervious. And here's a depiction of a chain well system, so-called kanat, or kharez, as they're called in Persia. And they're present throughout the Middle East and all the way to northwest Africa, where the streams, the intermittent streams, emerge from the mountain ranges. Much of the water soaks into the debris, into the alluvium, the gravelly alluvium, and can be tapped and then conveyed by underground channels. And these underground channels may be many, many miles long. Imagine people crawling through these channels with a digging stick to try to
convey that water to where it can be utilized for irrigation and to supply water to villages. Chain wells. I mentioned the hydraulic civilizations, and there are three main centers. I'm going to avoid talking about the Indus River, but the earliest and most successful, for a time, river valley civilization in southern Mesopotamia, the land of the Sumerians, the Akkadians, the Babylonians, and then the Assyrians. And this is how they would convey water. They gradually learned to mechanize the conveyance of water. They used beams or levers, then they used this rotary device. And in the upper right, you have what is known as the Archimedes screw, attributed to the Greek scientist Archimedes of Syracuse. Here's an ancient cedar plow developed in Mesopotamia. You see one man leading the oxen, another man holding the plow on the right and grooving the soil, and a third man dribbling seeds into this tube. The tube was made of hollowed reeds into the bottom of the furrow. So here you have the forerunner of the modern grain drill. And then depictions of fruit tree gardens in river valleys. So you see the canals, the distributaries conveying the water, distributing the water. And you might call this a Garden of Eden. The word Eden in Hebrew means delight, a garden of delight. But the cultivation of riverine land was very tenuous, very vulnerable to degradation in a way that the ancient people could not have foreseen, because occasionally the river rises above its levees that confine it, flood over the land, and gradually raise the water table. And the water table could not be controlled by the ancient people. It was very deep at first, in these river valleys that are very, very flat and far from the sea. And so the water table rose beneath their feet, and as long as it was some tens of meters below the surface, they didn't notice it. Gradually it came close to the ground surface, and a process of capillary rise began, and reinfusion of the soil surface with these salts that well up from below. And gradually this poisoned the land, so we have vast stretches of land in southern Mesopotamia, which today are sterile land, that were once productive fields. And we have mounds that encapsulate ancient cities that were left literally high and dry by this process of waterlogging and salination or salinization that is still the scourge of irrigated farming in many areas around the world, not excepting the parts of the United States. Here we have in contrast a river valley that runs through the driest desert in the world, the Sahara Desert, the Sahara, and it is the Nile River. It receives its waters from two sources. The White Nile originates from the rainforest regions of Central Africa, and it provides a steady stream of water that conveys not only water, but also organic matter, a kind of a milky suspension of organic matter that the water derives from the swamps of the Sud, which are today in southern Sudan. The other source of the Nile is much less steady. It is intermittent. The Blue Nile receives its waters from the annual monsoonal rains that come rolling in from the Indian Ocean annually and lash the rain over the volcanic highlands of western Ethiopia. And annually there's a surge of water containing that very fertile silt from Ethiopia. And so the Nile is in spate, and it floods over its narrow valley. But over most of its course, the River Nile runs below the level of the land. So it does not truly flood a large area of land. And then at the recession of the flood, the level of the water in the Nile decreases and drains the land. So you have a marvelous system of automatic irrigation, fertilization with the silt and the organic matter that I mentioned before, carried by the water, and then the water level falls, so the land drains itself. There's this pulsation of irrigation, fertilization, and then drainage, automatic drainage. And therefore, the hymn to the Nile, we find many such hymns in Egyptian remains. The Nile was the giver of life. Egypt was the gift of the Nile, as Herodotus said. And this is the god of the Nile, worshipped by the Egyptians, known as Hapi, depicted as a kind of a hermaphrodite with the breasts of the female and the genitals of the male, able to fructify self. And here are the fruits provided by the god of the Nile. And there is the depiction of a very early pharaoh or king of Egypt called the Scorpion King. We don't know his name, but he's always depicted with a scorpion next to his head, a kind of symbol of power and a kind of a threat to those who might be his enemies. And here he is inaugurating a distributary canal to increase the area of land irrigated in Egypt. There's a depiction of Egyptian farming, hoeing the land, spreading the seed, working it in, the gathering of the grain, and the storage of the grain. Much of this, by the way, is depicted in the Bible and in the book, both of Genesis and Exodus. This is the source of the Nile, the Blue Nile coming from Lake Tana in Ethiopia and joining with the White Nile in an area that is called Jezira, which is a kind of a peninsula. And the city of Khartoum, by the way, Khartoum in Arabic means the trunk of an elephant, because the coming together of the two rivers into a united trunk, it somehow reminded the ancients, and perhaps it might remind us too, of the trunk of an elephant. There is the present day land of Egypt, and you can see the Aswan High Dam, which was built by the Egyptians some 40 years ago to control the river and permit the perennial, repeated irrigation and the growth of not one crop per year, but two, three, or even four crops per year in succession. And in the process of damming the Nile and controlling the level of the water, they have set in motion, they have created a high water table and set in motion the process of capillary rise and salination, to which the land of Egypt had been immune for some 5, 6, 7,000 years previously. There's this dam and the huge lake that evaporates between 12 and 16 billion cubic meters every year in the middle of the driest desert of the world. Now, I'm afraid, how am I doing time-wise, Dr. Brevik? I have 25. Okay, so we'll go through other locations around the world that are problematic. And here's one that an area in which I have occasion to work in recent years, the Aral Sea. The Aral Sea in Central Asia was the fourth largest body of fresh water in the world, fed by two brimming rivers that conveyed the melting snows of the Tian Shan and the mountains of Central Asia, these high mountains. And under the Soviet regime, these rivers were diverted for the irrigation of land. Land was flattened, desert land, the Karakum, and for the production of cotton. And this area supplied some 95% of the cotton supply to the Soviet Union over many years, and gradually, as a consequence of the diversion of the waters, the lake began to shrink, and It shrunk so badly that it is now down to less than a quarter of its original water content, and many of the lands are now salinized because of that high water table condition that is repeated in modern times. And in addition to the salt, there's also the residues of all the pesticides, the insecticides that are applied to cotton fields, and of course the fertilizer residues. And so the lake has been shrinking markedly, and this is a sad consequence of hasty development that did not provide for the sustainability of irrigated land. Similar conditions occur around the world, and these are random examples. Many of us know and have visited the areas of Australia where people, starting 150 years ago, began to clear the forests of eucalypts and acacia trees, and in the process, and substituting short season, shallow rooted crops, and in the process, setting up this excess percolation that lifted the water table, and the water table mobilized ancient salt that had been conveyed to the land by sea spray over the many eons of time, and so gradually the water table rises and infuses the soil in many places, so you have splotches of brine emerging in some of what had been the most productive lands of southern and southwestern Australia. And then we have the problems of the central zone, the Murray-Darling Valley of southeastern Australia, and an example of salination. I'm showing you this. The Australians are among the best soil scientists in the world, and surely they will address and are addressing these issues. And yet, I'm showing you this to illustrate that the ancient problems are still with us. Another problem is the problem of seawater intrusion through excess exploitation of aquifers along seashores, coastal aquifers. And here is an example, just one of many, of unexpected consequences of modern development. The Jordan River, the Earth's most storied river, where there's been so much history, has in recent decades, starting in the middle of the 20th century, been diverted for irrigation of dry lands by the Israelis, by the Syrians, and the Jordanians. And as a consequence, the Dead Sea, which is the lowest spot on the Earth's continental surface, it is over 1,200 feet below sea level, began to shrink because it's been deprived of its primary replenishment. And as it sinks, the shoreline recedes, the lake shrinks, and the land that is exposed begins to sink. And we have a series of sinkholes. It looks awful. It looks like the biblical Sodom and Gomorrah, almost. These sinkholes result from the fact that water, rainwater, seeping down from the Judean hills, dissolve the salt that's under the soil and cause the soil to collapse. And so there are thousands of these collapsed sinkholes, and it's an awful sight, and it cannot be controlled as long as the Dead Sea continues to recede and to shrink. There's the brine, super saturated brine of the Dead Sea appearing at the bottom of these sinkholes. These people are standing there at their own risk. The land is cracking beneath their feet. shall skip some of this. Some of the solutions are judicious, more careful, and more highly controlled uses of water and control of the water table. And this is going to be my last slide before I rest my case and submit myself to questions from the audience or refutations or whatever you, argumentation, anything. These are the two spirals, the downward spiral of soil mismanagement and the upward spiral of proper soil management. We have the choice. We do not have the excuse of the earlier generations that they didn't know what the consequences are going to be. We know the consequences. We understand the longer term effects and the teleconnections. And so we have the choice of either spiraling upwards to sustainable production or spiraling downwards to our own self-destruction.